My laughter echoes down the eastern walls and over the dark fields. I double over, hands pressed against the smooth parapet, gasping for breath. I can't control it. True laughter, the deep kind from the pit of my stomach, takes over. The noise is hollow, harsh, and dusty from disuse. My scars bite, stinging along my neck and spine, but I can't hold it back. I laugh until my ribs hurt and I have to sit down, putting my back against the cold stone. It doesn't stop, and even when I bite my lips closed, little bursts still make it through. No one can hear me but the patrols, and I doubt they care about a single girl laughing alone in the darkness. I've earned the right to laugh or cry or scream as I see fit. Little pieces of me want to do all three, but laughter wins out. I sound deranged, and maybe I am. I certainly have an excuse after today. People are still clearing bodies from the other side of Corvium. Cal chose his crown over everything I thought we were fighting for. Both are still bleeding wounds no healer can fix. Wounds I have to ignore right now, for my own sanity. The only thing I can do is put my face in my hands, clench my teeth, and fight my infernal, idiotic laugh. This is complete and total lunacy. Evangeline, Cal, and me, all headed to Montfort? What a terrific joke! I said as much in my message to Killorn, still safe back in Piedmont. He would want to know about everything, as much as I could say. After I convinced him to stay behind, it's only fair to keep him in the loop. And of course, I want him in the loop. I want someone else to laugh with me and curse over what's to come. I chuckled darkly again, tipping my head back against the stonework. The stars above me are pinpricks, dimmed by the city lights of Corvium as well as the rising moon. The stars seem to watch, looking down at the fortress city. I wonder if Iris Signet's gods are laughing with me, if they even exist. I wonder if John is laughing too. The thought of him chills my blood, killing whatever manic giggle I have left. That wretched, prophesizing new blood is out there somewhere, having escaped us. But to do what? Sit on a hill and watch? Let his red eyes tick back and forth as we all kill each other? Is he some kind of game master, content to nudge us into position and play out whatever future he chooses? If it were remotely possible, I would try to find him, force him to protect us from lethal fate. But that's absurd. He'll see me coming. We can only find John if he wants to be found. Frustrated, I scrub my fingers over my face and scalp, letting my nails drag across my skin. The sharp sensation brings me back to reality, little by little. So does the cold. The stone beneath my body loses warmth as night wears on. The thin fabric of my uniform does little to keep me from shivering, while the sharp, solid edges of the wall are hardly comfortable. Still, I don't move. Moving means sleep, but it also means going back down. To the others. To the barracks. Even if I don my best scowl and run, I'll have to face reds and new bloods and silvers, too. Julian, certainly. I can just imagine him waiting on my cot, ready with another lecture. What he could possibly say, I don't know. He'll side with Cal, I think. At the end of all this, when it becomes clear, we won't let Cal keep his throne. Silvers are nothing if not loyal to blood, and Julian is nothing if not loyal to his dead sister. Cal is the last piece of her left. He won't turn his back on that, even for all his talk of revolution and history. He won't leave Cal alone. Tiberius. Call him Tiberius. It even hurts to think the name. His real name. His future. Tiberius Killorn the Seventh, King of Norta. Flame of the North. I picture him on his brother's throne, safe in a cage of silent stone. Or would he drag out the diamond glass inferno his father set, destroy every shred of Maven, erase him from history? He'll rebuild his father's palace. The kingdom of Norta will return to the way it was. Except for the Samos king in the rift, everything will go back to what it was meant to be the day I fell into the arena. Making everything that has occurred since that day be for nothing. I refuse to let that happen. And luckily, I'm not alone in this endeavor. The moonlight glows on the black stone, making the gold accents of every tower and parapet gleam silver. Patrols wind below me, guards in red and green uniforms keeping a watch. Scarlet Guard and Montfort. Their counterparts, silvers and house colors, are less frequent, and they clump together. Yellow Laris, black Haven, red and blue Eral, red and orange Larilan. No Samos colors. They're royal now, thanks to Volo's ambition and opportunity. No need to waste their time on something as ordinary as the nightly rounds. I wonder what Maven thinks of that. He fixated on Tiberius so much, I can only imagine the weight of another rival king like Volo. Everything revolved around his brother, even though Maven seemingly had everything he could want. The crown, the throne, me. He still felt that shadow. Ilara's doing. She coiled and curled him into what she needed, cutting away and building up in equal measure. His obsession helped fuel his need for power and enabled her own. Will it extend to King Volo? Or are Maven's darkest and most dangerous desires restricted to us? Kill Tiberius. Keep me. Only time will tell. When he strikes again, and he will, I'll know. I only hope we're ready. Davidson's troops, the Scarlet Guard, and our spreading infiltration. We're enough. We have to be. But that doesn't mean I can't take precautions. When do we leave? It took some dreaded social interaction, but I managed to ask my way to Davidson's quarters. He commands some larger offices in the administrative sector, forming a suite currently filled with Montfort brass. And Scarlet Guard, too, although Farley isn't here. The officers take my entrance in stride, giving way to the person they still call Lightning Girl. Most busy themselves with packing. Papers, folders, charts, mostly. Nothing that actually belongs to anyone here. Intelligence for smarter people than me to devour. Probably left over from whatever silver officers used this space last. Ada, one of my new blood recruits, is at the center of the activity. Her eyes run over every scrap of paper before someone else packs it away. She's memorizing it all, using her ability of perfect memory. I catch her eye as I pass, and we share a nod. When we go to Montfort, Ada will be dispatched to command at Farley's orders. I don't suppose I'll see her again for a long time. Davidson looks up from his bare desk. The corners of his angled eyes crinkle, the only indicator of a smile. Despite the harsh, unforgiving light of the office, he looks handsome as ever. Distinguished, intimidating, a king in power, if not title. When he waves me over, I swallow hard, remembering what he looked like in the siege. Bloody, exhausted, afraid, and determined, just like the rest of us. It calms me a little. "You did well up there, Barrow," he says. With a toss of his head, he gestures in the vague direction of the core tower. I blink, scoffing. "You mean I kept my mouth shut?" At the window, someone laughs. I glance over to see Titan, leaning against the glass, arms crossed, his usual lock of white hair drooping over one eye. He has a clean forest green uniform too, though a little short at the wrists and legs. No lightning insignia to mark him for what he is. An electrocon, like me. Because it isn't his uniform. The last time I saw him, he was painted eyebrows to ankles in silver blood. He drums his fingers against his arm, brandishing them like the weapons they are.
"Is that possible?"
he says without looking at me, his voice deep. Davidson surveys me, shaking his head a bit.
"Actually, I'm pleased with what you told the others, Mayor, about accompanying me home."
Like I said, I'm curious about... The Premier puts up his hand, palm out, to stop me short.
"Save it. I think Lord Jacobs is the only person here who does anything simply for the sake of curiosity."
Well, he isn't wrong.
"What do you really want from Montfort?"
At the window, Titan's eyes flicker in the light as he finally deigns to look at me. I raise my chin. "Only what you promised."
"Resettlement?"
For once, Davidson looks truly startled.
"You want to... I want my family safe."
My voice never wavers. I push a little of what I remember from a dead Silver and her etiquette rules into my bearing. Straight spine, squared shoulders, hold eye contact.
"We are truly at war," I say.
"Norda, Piedmont, the Lakelands, and your republic too. Nowhere is safe from either side. But you're farthest away, and you seem to be the strongest, or at least the most defended. I think it will be best if I can take my family there myself, before I come back to finish what better people started."
"The promise was for new bloods, Miss Barrow,"
Davidson says quietly. The flurry of activity around us almost drowns him out. My stomach drops, but I harden my expression. "I don't think so, Premier." He pulls that bland smile of his, retreating behind his usual mask.
"Really? You think me so heartless?"
A strange joke, but Davidson is nothing if not a strange man. He flashes even teeth.
"Of course your family is welcome. Montfort would be proud to accept them as citizens.
Iberum, a word," he adds, calling over my shoulder. A man bustles in from one of the connecting rooms, and I can't help but jump. He's the spitting image of Rash and Tahir, the new blood twins. If I didn't know Tahir was still in Piedmont and Rash embedded in Archeon, both relaying information for the cause, I would think he was one of the twins.
"Triplets," I quickly realize, and a bitterness fills my mouth.
I don't like surprises. Like his brothers, Iberum has dark brown skin, black hair, and a well-manicured beard. I can just glimpse a scar beneath the hair on his chin, a single white line of raised flesh. He's marked, too. Cut by a silver lord long ago to distinguish him from his identical siblings.
"Pleased to meet you,"
I mutter, narrowing my eyes at Davidson. He senses my unease.
"Ah, yes, this would be the brother of Rash and Tahir."
"Couldn't tell," I shoot back dryly. Ibram's lips twist into a small smile as he nods his head in greeting.
"Glad to make your acquaintance at last, Miss Barrow."
Then he turns to the Premier, expectant.
"What do you need, Premier?"
Davidson eyes him.
"Send word to Tahir. Have him inform the Barrow family that their daughter will be collecting them tomorrow, for resettlement in Montfort."
"Yes, sir," he replies. His eyes glaze for a moment, as the message travels from his brain to his brother's. It only takes a second, despite the hundreds of miles between them. He ducks his head again.
"Relayed, sir. Tahir says congratulations and welcome, Miss Barrow."
I only hope my parents accept the offer. Not that they wouldn't. Geesa wants to go, and Mom will follow her lead. Bree and Traymi will follow Mom. But Dad? I'm not sure. Not if he knows I won't be staying with them.
"Please go. Please let me give you this."
"Tell him thanks," I mumble, still disconcerted by him.
"Relayed," Iberum says again.
"Tahir says you're very welcome."
Thank you both, Davidson cuts in, and for good reason. The brothers can go back and forth with maddening speed, although it's worse when their linked brains are side by side. Ibram nods, taking the dismissal, before shuffling away to continue his work elsewhere. Are there any more of them you'd like to tell me about? I hiss, leaning forward to grit my teeth at the Premier. He takes my annoyance in stride.
No, though I wish I had more of their like at my disposal. He sighs. Funny, those brothers. Usually Ardens have silver counterparts, but I've never seen their like beyond our blood.
His brain feels different from any other.
Titan mutters. I eye him sharply. The way you say that is very disconcerting. Titan only shrugs. I turn back to Davidson, still smarting, but unable to ignore what a gift he's just given me. Thank you for doing this. I know you lead the country and it may not seem like much, but this means a great deal to me.
Of course it does, he replies. And I hope to do the same for other families like yours, as soon as we are able. My government is currently debating how to face what is rapidly becoming a refugee crisis, as well as how to move already displaced Reds and Newbloods. But for you, for what you've done and continue to do, exceptions can be made.
And what have I done? Really? The words slip out before I can bite them back. Heat spreads across my cheeks.
You've made cracks in the impenetrable.
Davidson speaks like he's pointing out the obvious. Put dents in armor.
You loosened the proverbial jar, Miss Barrow. Let us break it open.
His grin is true, wide, and white and stretching. I'm reminded of a cat.
And it's no small thing that because of you, a claimant to the throne of Norta will be coming to the Republic.
That sends a jolt through me. Is that a threat? I move quickly, leaning over his desk, my palms braced against the wood, my voice low, in warning. I want your word he won't be harmed. He doesn't hesitate.
You have it, he says, matching my tone. I won't touch a hair on his head, nor will anyone else, not while Kalor is in my country. You have my solemn promise. That's not how I operate.
Good, I reply, because it would be ridiculously stupid to remove the buffer between our alliance and Maven Kalor. And you aren't a stupid person, are you, Premier? That cat smile widens. He nods.
Won't it be good for the little prince to see something different?
Davidson cocks one manicured gray eyebrow. A country without a king? See that it's possible. That the crown, the throne, they aren't his duty. He doesn't have to be a king or a prince, not if he doesn't want to be. But I think he wants to be. Yes, is all I can say, and all I can hope for. After all, didn't I first meet Tiberius in a dark tavern, where he pretended to be someone else so he could see what the world really looked like? See what should change. Davidson leans back, clearly finished with me. I do the same.
Consider your request granted, he says, and consider yourself lucky we have to return to Piedmont first anyway, or else I might not be so amenable to retrieving a metric ton of barrows.
He almost winks. I almost smile. Halfway to the barracks, I realize I'm being followed through the fortress city. Footsteps trail close behind, nimble, and even along the winding street. The fluorescent lights cast two shadows, mine and someone else's. I tense, uneasy but not afraid. Corvium is crawling with coalition soldiers, and if any of them are stupid enough to wish me harm, they're welcome to try. I can protect myself. Sparks ripple beneath my skin, easy to unleash, ready to loose. I turn on my boot heel, hoping to catch whoever it is off guard. It doesn't work.
Evangeline stops smoothly, expectant, her arms crossed and dark, perfect eyebrows raised. She still wears her opulent armor, the kind better suited to a king's court than a battleground. No crown, though. She used to spend her free time fashioning tiaras and circlets from whatever metal she could get her hands on. But now, when she has every right to wear one, her head is bare.
"I trailed you through two sectors of the city, Barrow,"
she says, tossing back her head.
"I thought you were supposed to be some kind of thief."
My incessant laugh from earlier tugs again, and I can't help but smirk, huffing out a breath. Her bite is familiar, and anything familiar feels like comfort right now. "Never change, Evangeline." Her smile flashes, quick as a knife.
"Of course not. Why change perfection?"
"Well, please don't let me keep you from your perfect life, Your Highness," I tell her. Still smirking, I step aside, clearing the way for her, calling her bluff. Evangeline Samos did not seek me out to trade insults. Her behavior in the council chamber made her motives very clear. She blinks, and a bit of her boldness melts.
"There," she says, softer now, pleading.
But her pride won't let her do much more than almost beg. That damn silver spine. She doesn't know how to bend. No one ever taught her, and no one would ever allow her to try. Despite everything between us, a sliver of pity arrows through my heart. Evangeline was raised in the silver court, born to scheme and climb, made to fight as fiercely as she guards her mind. But her mask is far from perfect, especially compared to Maven's. After months of reading shadows in his eyes, I see Evangeline's thoughts reflected in hers, clear as daylight. Pain radiates from her. Longing. She has the feel of a predator in a cage, with no chance of escaping. Part of me wants to leave her trapped. Let her realize exactly what kind of life she used to want. I want to believe I'm not that cruel. And I'm not stupid. Evangeline Samos would make a powerful ally, and if I have to buy her with whatever she wants, so be it. "If you're looking for sympathy, keep walking," I mutter, gesturing again to the empty street. A useless threat, but she bristles anyway. Her eyes, already black, darken. The jibe works, pushing her into a corner, forcing her to speak. "I don't want an inch of it from you," Evangeline snaps. The needle edges of her armor sharpen with her anger. "And I know I don't deserve it, either." "Definitely not," I snort. "So you want help, then? An excuse not to go to Montfort with the rest of our happy crew?" Evangeline's face twists into another biting smile. "I'm hardly idiotic enough to owe you anything." "No. I'm talking about a trade." I keep my face still, my eyes locked on hers. I channel a little bit of Davidson's serene, unfathomable blankness. "I thought you might be. Good to know you aren't as dense as people seem to think." "So, what do you have?" I ask, wanting to hurry this along. "We're leaving for Piedmont and then Montfort tomorrow. We don't have the luxury of our usual barbs." "What do you want?" The words stick in her throat. She drags her teeth across her lips, scraping away a bit of the purple stain. In the unforgiving light of the Corvium street, her makeup seems harsh, more like war paint. I suppose it is. The purple shadows below her cheekbones, meant to sculpt her features into impossible sharpness, seem sickly in the dark. Even the shimmering white powder on her skin, smoothing her moonbeam complexion, has flaws. Tear tracks. She tried to cover them up, but the evidence is still there. Uneven color, a hint of black paint from her lashes still leaving their mark. Her walls of beauty and lethal magnificence have deep cracks. "But that's easy, isn't it?" I answer my own question, taking a step closer.
She almost flinches. All this time, all your scheming. You have Tiberius. You have a third chance to marry a Kalor king, become queen of Norta, achieve everything you've ever worked for. Her throat bobs, swallowing a probably rude response. We don't have much practice being civil to each other.
And you want out,
I whisper. You don't want to be what you were born for. Why the sudden revelation? Why throw away what you used to want so much? Her restraint breaks.
I don't have to explain myself or my reasons to you. Your reason has red hair and answers to Elaine Haven.
Evangeline tenses, fists clenching, and the scales of her armor tighten, responding to her sudden emotions.
Don't talk about her,
she snaps, revealing her weakness, the easy leverage we can use. She closes the distance between us. Evangeline is several inches taller than me, and she wields this slim advantage well. With her hands on her hips, eyes glaring, her shoulders square against the city lights, I'm entirely in her shadow. I blink up at her, tilting my head. So, you want to go back to her? And what? You think I can stop Tiberius from marrying you?
Don't flatter yourself,
she snaps back, rolling her eyes.
You're a good distraction for Kalor kings. Yes, but I'm not delusional. Cal won't break our betrothal. Maven, maybe. You certainly influenced his decision to cast me aside.
As if you were ever really going to marry Maven. I tell Evangeline slowly. I saw more than she realizes back in Maven's court. Her family took the monumental slight too well. The Kingdom of the Rift was planned long before I nudged Maven in any direction. Evangeline shrugs.
I was never going to be his queen after Ilara died.
Excuse me,
after you killed her,
she says quickly.
She could hold his leash, at least. Keep him in check. I don't think anyone alive can do that now. Not even you.
I nod in agreement. There is no controlling Maven Kalor. Though I certainly tried. Bile rises in my throat at the memory, my attempts to manipulate the boy king, playing on his weakness for me. And then Maven traded House Samos for peace, for the Lakelands, for a princess just as deadly and probably twice as cunning as Evangeline. I wonder if he met his match in Iris Signet, the quiet, calculating nymph. I try to picture him now, fleeing Corvium for the Lakelands, his white face above a uniform of black and red, blue eyes sparking with quiet fury. Retreating to a strange kingdom and a strange court, without the protection of his silent stone. With nothing to show but the corpse of the King of the Lakelands. It comforts me a bit to know he failed so spectacularly. Perhaps the Queen of the Lakelands will kill him outright, to punish him for wasting her husband's life on the siege. I couldn't drown Maven when I had the chance. Maybe she will.
And you can't command Cal, either. Not in any way that could achieve what I want.
Evangeline pushes on, her words a twisting knife.
He won't put me aside for you.
Not if the crown hangs in the balance.
Sorry, Barrow. He's not the abdicating kind.
I know what kind he is. I sneer back, feeling her jab as keenly as she feels mine.
If my life continues this way, with almost everything I do poking at this wound, I doubt it will ever have time to heal. He's made his choice,
she says, both to punish me and to make a point.
When he wins back Norta, and he will, I'll marry him, cement an alliance, ensure the rift survives, carry on the legacy of Folo Samos and his kings of steel.
Evangeline looks past me, down the dark street. A patrol walks the adjoining avenue 10 yards away, their voices low and even as their footsteps. Scarlet Guard, judging by the rust-colored uniforms. Most are repurposed from the red uniforms of the Norton Army, their insignia ripped off.
I doubt Evangeline notices. Her eyes glaze, and she thinks of something far away. Something she doesn't like at all, judging by her clenching jaw.
And if you don't marry him?
I prod, bringing her back. It's the easy, obvious thing to ask, but she blanches, perplexed by the suggestion. Her eyes widen, her mouth dropping open in shock.
Impossible, she scoffs. There's no way around it, short of running away to Taraxis or Ceron or whatever backwater my father can't invade,
she adds, laughing darkly at the idea.
Even that won't work. He'll find me wherever I go, drag me back, and use me as I was intended to be used. The only course I see, the only option I have, is very simple.
Of course it is, Evangeline. Our objectives are the same, though our motivations differ. I let her talk, spooling out exactly what I want to hear. Things will be easier if she thinks this is all her own idea.
There will be no marriage if Cal fails.
Evangeline stares through me. She forces the words. They're a betrayal. Of her house, of her colors, of her father, of her blood. It cuts her bone deep.
If he isn't King of Norta, my father won't waste me on him. And if he loses his war for the crown, if we lose, father will be too distracted keeping his own throne to sell me off to someone else, or at least sell me somewhere far away.
From Elaine. Her meaning is clear. So you want me to stop Cal from winning back his kingdom? She sneers, taking a step back.
You've learned many things in Silver Courts, Mayor Barrow. You're smarter than you seem. I won't underestimate you ever again, and you better not underestimate me.
As she speaks, her armor skitters, reforming and twisting along her limbs. The scales shrink and crawl. Like the bugs of her mother's control, each one a gleaming dot of black and silver. She reforms her clothing into something more substantial, less grand, real armor, meant for battle and nothing else.
When I say I want you to stop Cal, I mean your little circle,
although I don't know how little both Montfort and the Scarlet Guard can be considered. After all, they can't really mean to prop up another Silver Kingdom, not without some serious strings attached.
Ah.
My heart drops a little. There's a card shown, one I would have liked to keep hidden.
Yes, well, it doesn't take a political genius to know that a red and silver coalition will be fraught with betrayal. I'm certain all the leaders know not to trust one another.
Her eyes flash as she turns, meaning to leave me behind.
Except for maybe one aspiring king,
she adds over her shoulder. A fact I know too well. Tiberius is as trusting as a new puppy, easily led by the people he loves. Me, his grandmother, and most of all his dead father. He pursues the crown for that man, to serve some bond that hasn't broken. While his confidence, his courage, and his dogged focus make him strong, they also make him blind everywhere but the battlefield. He can predict surging armies, but not scheming people. He won't see, or can't see, the machinations around him. He didn't before, and he won't again.
He's certainly not Maven, I mutter, if only to myself.
I hear an echo from Evangeline all the same, bouncing off the stone walls of Corvium.
He's certainly not,
she replies. In her voice, I hear the same things I feel. Relief and regret.
4. Iris. The bay laps at my bare ankles, refreshing, renewing. It's cold before the sunrise, but I hardly feel the chill. I find sanctuary in the simple sensation. I know these waters as well as I know my own face. I can feel them far beyond my feet, The pulse of the softest current, the smallest ripple of the river feeding the bay, and the bay feeding the lake. The coming light of dawn bleeds across the smooth surface. The mirror image distorts in streaks of pale blue and rose pink. Such calm lets me forget who I am, but not for long. I am Iris Signet, a princess born, a queen made. I don't have the luxury of forgetting anything, no matter how much I may want to. We wait together, my mother, my sister, and I, our attention fixed on the southern horizon. Fog hangs low across the narrow mouth of Clear Bay, obstructing the peninsula dotted with guard towers, as well as Lake Iris beyond. A few lights from the towers twinkle through the fog, like stars hanging low. As the fog shifts, moving in the wind off the lake, more and more towers come into view. Tall stone structures, improved and rebuilt 100 times over hundreds of years. The towers have seen more war and ruin than even historians can say. Their lights flare, too many ablaze this close to dawn. But the beacons will remain all day, torches burning and electric lights beaming. The flags streaming in the breeze are different from the usual standard of the Lakelands. Each tower flies cobalt blue slashed with black, to honor so many dead in Corvium, to mourn, to say goodbye to our king. I shed my tears already, in hours spent crying last night. I shouldn't have any more tears left to give, but still they come. My sister, Tiora, keeps herself in better check. She raises her chin, a diadem crown winking across her brow. It's a braid of dark sapphire and jet, hung low across her forehead. Even though I am a queen now, my crown is more simple, barely a string of blue diamonds punctuated by red gems to symbolize Norta. We have the same cold bronze skin, the same face, high cheekbones and sharply arched eyebrows. But her deep mahogany eyes belong to our mother. I have father's gray. Tiora is 23, 4 years my elder, and the heir to the throne of the Lakelands. I used to say she was born grim and silent, loath to cry, unable to laugh. Her serious nature serves her well as my mother's heir. She has far more skill in controlling her emotions, though I do my best to keep still as the lakes. Tiora locks her gaze forward, her spine straight with the pride not even a funeral can break. Despite her stoic nature, even she cries for our lost father. Her tears are less evident, quickly dropping into the bay, swirling around our feet. She's a nymph like the rest of our family, and uses her ability to cast the tears away and leave nothing of them behind. I would do the same if I had the strength, but I can't summon anything right now. Not so for our mother, Senra, the ruling queen of the Lakelands. Her tears hover in the air, a cloud of crystal droplets to catch the spreading light of dawn. One by one the cloud grows, and the tears turn steadily, flashing in time, sending faint rainbows arching across her brown skin, diamonds born from her broken heart. She stands in front of us, knee-deep in the water, her mourning gown floating out behind her. Like Tiora and me, Mother wears mostly black, slashed with our regal blue. The dress is finely made in intricate layers of thin silk, but it's shapeless, hanging off her like an afterthought. While Tiora took care to make sure we were both prepared for the funeral, choosing jewels and gowns to suit, Mother did no such thing. She looks plain, her hair undone in a sleek trail of raven and storm. No bracelets, no earrings, no crown. A queen only in bearing. And that's enough. I'm tempted to cling to her skirts like I did when I was a child. I could hold on to her and never let go, never leave home again, never return to a court falling to pieces around an already broken king. The thought of my husband turns me cold and resolute. The tears dry on my cheeks. Maven Kalor is a child playing with a loaded gun. Whether or not he knows how to shoot remains to be seen, but I certainly have targets in mind, people to point him at. The Silver who killed my father, of course, some Iral lord. He cut his throat, attacked him from behind like some honorless dog. But Iral served another king, Samos, Volo. Another without any claim to honor or dignity. He rebelled for a petty crown, for little more than the right to call himself master of some insignificant corner of the world. And he isn't alone. Other Norton families stand with him, ready to replace Maven with the other Kalor brother, the Exile. Before my father died, I wouldn't have minded if Maven had suddenly found himself deposed or dead. If the Norton and Lakelander peace held, what difference would it make to me? But not now. Oryx Signet is gone. My father died because of men like Volo Samos and Tiberius Kalor. What I would do to line them up and drown them with my fury. What I will do. Boats break through the fog, moving quietly. The three crafts are familiar, their bows painted silver and blue. Only a single deck to each. Dawn boats aren't built for war, but for speed, silence, and the will of powerful nymphs. Their hulls are specially grooved to catch forced currents as they do now. It was my idea to send the boats. I couldn't bear the thought of Father's body dragged on the long march from Moor, the land the Nortons call the Choke. He would have to pass through many towns on the way, news of his death racing ahead of that gruesome parade. No. I wanted him to come home, so we could say goodbye first. And so I wouldn't lose my nerve. Nymphs in Lakelander Blue, our cousins of the Signet line, crowd the deck of the lead dawn boat. Grief shadows their dark faces, each one mourning as we are. Father was well-loved among our line, though he came from a lesser branch of the family. Mother is the royal one, descended from a long, unbroken lineage of monarchs. As such, she is not permitted to cross the borders of our country, except in the gravest of need. Teora isn't allowed to leave at all, even in war, to preserve the line of succession. At least they will never share Father's fate, to die in battle. Or mine, to live my days so far away from home. My husband isn't difficult to spot against the dark blue uniforms. Four sentinels guard him, their flaming robes exchanged for tactical gear. But they still have their masks studded with dark gemstones, both beautiful and gruesome. Maven wears his usual black, standing out sharply despite his lack of medals, crown, or insignia. No monarch is stupid enough to march into battle with that kind of target painted on his body. Not that I think he fought at all. Maven isn't a warrior, not on the battlefield at least. He looks so small next to his soldiers and mine. Weak. I thought as much when we first met, eyeing each other across the pavilion in the middle of a minefield. He's still a teenager, barely more than a child, a year younger than I am. Still, he knows how to use his appearance to his advantage. He plays to those assumptions. It works on his country. The people spoon-fed his lies and painted on innocence. Reds and silvers outside his court lap up the tales of his brother, the Golden Prince seduced by a spy and driven to murder. A juicy story, a lovely piece of gossip for people to latch onto. Paired with Maven's bringing an end to the war between our countries, it makes Maven so much more appealing. And it puts him in an odd position. He is a king supported by his people, but not the ones closest to him. Not the nobles still clinging to his heels. They remain because they need him to preserve a now delicate kingdom. And, loath as I am to admit it, because Maven is a skilled court schemer, he balances the nobles well, playing houses off each other, all while maintaining an iron grip on the rest of the nation. The royal court of Norda is a court of snakes, now more than ever. Maven's machinations will never work on me, though. I know better than to underestimate him. Especially now, when his obsessions seem to rule. His mind is as splintered as his country, making him all the more dangerous. The first boat glides to shore, its draft shallow enough to beach it a few yards from Mother. The nymphs go first, jumping into the water. The lake leaps away from their feet, allowing the cousins to walk on dry lake bed. Not for their sake, but for Maven's. He follows closely, jumping down to get on dry land as quickly as he can. Burners like him hold no love for water, and he eyes the liquid walls of his pathway with suspicion. I don't expect any sympathy as he walks past me, his sentinels in his wake. And I receive none. Not even a glance. For someone called the Flame of the North, his heart is brutally cold. The Signet cousins remain by the boat and release their grip on the bay waters. They rush and swell before rising up, like a creature raising its head, or a parent reaching out to hold a child. Soldiers lift a board from the deck, revealing a familiar sight. I'm not an infant. I've seen dead bodies before. My country has been at war for more than a century, and as the younger daughter, the second child, I'm free to walk the battle lines. I'm trained to fight, not to rule. It's my duty to support my sister as father did my mother, in whatever way she needs. Teora chokes back a rare sob. I take her hand. Still as the lakes, T, I whisper to her. She squeezes my hand in reply. Her features tighten into a blank mask. The Signet nymphs raise their arms, and the water mirrors their action, bulging upward. Slowly, the soldiers lower the board and the corpse draped in a single white sheet. It floats on the surface, easing down from the boat. Mother takes a few steps forward, moving deeper into the bay. She stops when her wrists are submerged, and I catch the subtle movement of her swirling fingers. My father's body glides over the surface toward her, as if pulled by invisible strings. Our cousins march alongside the king, flanking him even in death. Two of them are crying. When she reaches for the sheet, I fight the urge to shut my eyes. I want to preserve the memories I have of my father, not corrupt them all with the sight of his corpse. But I would regret it one day. Breathing slowly, I focus on maintaining some calm. The waters churn around my ankles, a gentle, swirling current to match the nausea in the pit of my stomach. I focus on it, tracing lazy circles with my mind to stop the worst of my grief from spilling over. I keep my teeth clenched, my chin high. The tears have not returned. His face is strange, drained of color as well as life. His smooth brown skin, barely wrinkled despite his age, has a pale undertone, the sickly kind. I wish he were only sick, not dead. Mother puts her hands on either side of his face, staring down at him with a strength I can't fathom. Her tears continue to hover like a swarm of glittering insects. After a long moment, she kisses his closed eyelids, fingers trailing through his long, iron-gray hair. Then she cups her hands over his face, forming a bowl. The tears collect, flowing onto her fingers. Finally, she lets them go. I almost expect him to flinch, but Father doesn't move. He can't anymore. Teora follows, using her hands to scoop water from the bay and trace it over his face. She lingers, studying him. She was always closer to her mother, as her position demands. It doesn't lessen her pain, though. Her composure wavers and she turns away, holding up a hand to hide her face. The world seems to shrink as I move through the water, my limbs sluggish and distant. Mother hovers, one hand on the sheet covering the rest of the body. She eyes me across him, her countenance still and empty. I know that look. I use it myself whenever I need to mask the storm of emotions beneath. I wore it on my wedding day. But then I was hiding fear, not pain. Not like this. I copy Teora, pouring the water over my father. The droplets roll off his aquiline nose and down his cheekbones, pooling in the hair beneath his head. I brush away a strand of gray, suddenly wishing I could cut a lock for myself. Back in Archeon, I have a small temple, a shrine more than anything, filled with candles and worn emblems of the nameless gods. Cramped as it may be, the tiny corner of the palace is the only spot I feel myself. I would like to keep him with me there. An impossible wish, When I pull back, Mother steps forward again. She puts her hands to the wooden board, palms flat. Tiora and I follow her lead. I've never done this before, and I wish I didn't have to. But it is as the gods command. Return, they bid, to what you are, to your ability. Bury a green warden, entomb a stone skin in marble and granite, drown a nymph. If I am alive when Maven dies, will I be permitted to burn his corpse? We push, lowering the board with our hands and our ability, using our own muscles and the weight of our current to sink the body. Even in the shallows, the water distorts his face. Dawn breaks to my left, the sun rising over the low hills. It flashes on the surface, blinding me for a moment. I shut my eyes and remember Father as he was. He returns to the water's embrace. Detraon is a city of canals, nymph cut into the bedrock on the western edge of Clear Bay. The ancient city that used to sit here is no more, washed away by floods more than 1,000 years ago. There are still massive fields of debris downriver, choked with the rotted ruins of another time. Rusted and iron dust turns the earth red to this day, and magnetrons harvest those stretches like farmers do wheat. When the water receded, the land here was still the perfect spot for our capital, sitting well beside Lake Iris, with easy access to Lake Naren through a short strait and the rest of the lakes beyond. From Detraon, over both natural and nymph-made waterways, we can quickly reach almost every corner of our kingdom. All the way from the Hud in the north to the disputed borders along the Great River in the west and the Ohias in the south. No nymph lord could resist, and so here we stay, drawing our strength and safety from the waters. The canals make for easy division, cutting the city into quarter sectors surrounding our central temples. Most Reds live in the southeast, farthest from the blissful waterfront, while the palace quarter and noble quarter sit on the bay itself, overlooking the waters we love so well. The Whirlpool Quarter, as it's commonly known, occupies the northeast, where both wealthier Reds and less important Silvers live in close proximity. It's merchants mostly, businessmen, lower officers and soldiers, poor students from the university in the Noble Quarter, as well as Reds of quality and necessity, skilled workers, independent usually, servants wealthy or important enough to live in Silver households, not their own. City governance is not my strong suit, and better left to Tiora, but I do what I can to acquaint myself with such things. Even if they bore me, I must know, at the very least. Ignorance is a burden I do not intend to carry. We don't use the canals today, as the palace is close enough to the bayfront. Good, I think, enjoying the familiar walk. Arches span the turquoise and gold walls of the noble sector, so fluid and smooth they can only be the work of Silvers. Family homes I know by heart peek up over the walls, their windows thrown open to the morning, dynastic colors streaming proudly in the breeze. The blood-red flag of the Renarde line, jade green for the peerless ancient storm line of Ciel. I name each in my head. Their sons and daughters fought for the new alliance. How many died alongside Father? How many that I knew? It looks to be a beautiful day, with the sun rising through a sky of sparse clouds. The wind off Iris continues, pawing through my hair with light fingers. I expect the smell of decay, destruction, defeat to come out of the east. But all I smell are the lake waters, wet and green with summer. No sign of the army limping toward us, its blood spent on the walls of Corvium. Our escort fans out, flint-eyed soldiers of the Lakelands, paired with Maven's own contingent. Most of his nobles are still with the army, moving as fast as the rest will allow. But he still has his sentinel guards. They hang close, as do two of his high-ranking generals, each with aides and guards of their own. The Lord General from House Greco is gray-haired, deceptively lean for a strong arm, but there's no mistaking the garish yellow and blue emblem on her shoulder. Tiora made sure I memorized the great lines of Norta, their houses, until I knew them as well as our own. The other, Lord General Makansos, blue and gray, is young with sandy hair and nervous eyes. Too young for his position. I suspect his rank is new, and he replaced a relative who died recently. Maven is smart enough to give my mother deference in her own country, and he walks a few steps behind her. I do as is expected, keeping pace at his side. We don't touch, not even the harmless link of arms or hands. It is his rule, not mine. He won't touch me, not since the day he lost his grip on Mayor Barrow. The last we felt of each other was a cold kiss beneath the gathering storm. For that I am quietly thankful. I know what my duty is as a Silver, as a queen, as a bridge between our countries. It's his duty too, a burden we are both supposed to bear. But if he won't push the subject of heirs, I'm certainly not going to. For one thing, I'm only 19, of age, surely, but I have plenty of time. And for another, if Maven fails, if his brother wins back the crown, I won't have a reason to stay. Without children, I'll be free to come home. I don't want any kind of anchor to Norta if I don't need one. Our gowns trail, leaving wet paths along the wide street abutting the water's edge. Sunlight gleams off the white stone. My eyes flit back and forth, taking in the sight of a summer day in my old capital. I wish I could stop as I used to, perch on the low wall dividing the avenue from the bay, practice my abilities with lazy attention. Maybe even tempt Tiora into a little friendly competition. But there isn't time, nor opportunity. I don't know how long we'll stay, or how long I have with what remains of my family. All I can do is stretch the moments, memorize them, tattoo them on my mind, like the swirling waves inked on my back.
I'm the first Norton king to set foot here in a century.
Maven's voice is low, cold. The snapping threat of winter and spring. After so many weeks in his court, I'm beginning to learn his moods, studying him as I did his country. The King of Norta is not a kind creature, and while my survival is necessary for our alliance, my comfort probably isn't. I try to be in his good graces, and so far it seems easy enough. He doesn't mistreat me. In fact, he doesn't treat me to much of anything at all. Staying out of his way takes little effort in the sprawl of Whitefire Palace. Over a century, if my memory serves, I answer, hiding my surprise at being spoken to. Tiberius II was the last Kalor king to make a state visit, before your ancestors and mine began the war. He hisses at the name, Tiberius. Resentments between siblings are not unfamiliar to me. There are many things I envy about Tiora. But I've never experienced anything like the deep and all-encompassing jealousy Maven feels toward his exiled brother. It runs bone deep. Every mention of him, even in official capacity, provokes him like the jab of a knife. I suppose the ancestral name is one more thing for him to covet, one more mark of a true king that he will never possess. Perhaps that's why he pursues Mayor Barrow with such dogged focus. The stories seem true enough. I've seen proof of them myself. She's not just a powerful new blood, the strange kind of red with abilities like our own, but the exiled prince loves her. A red girl. Having met her, I can almost understand why. Even imprisoned, she fought. She resisted. She was a puzzle I would have enjoyed piecing together. And it seems she's a trophy for Kalor brothers to scrap over. Nothing compared to the crown, but still something for jealous, feuding boys to tug back and forth, like dogs with a bone. I can arrange a tour of the capital, if your majesty would like, I continue. Though spending more time than I must with Maven is hardly ideal, it would mean more time in the city. The temples are renowned throughout the kingdom for their splendor. Your presence would certainly honor the gods. Feeding his ego doesn't work, as it usually does with nobles and courtiers. His lip curls.
I try to keep my focus on things that actually exist, Iris. Like the war we're both trying to win.
Suit yourself. I swallow the response with cool detachment. Non-believers are not my problem. I can't open their eyes,
and it isn't my job to do so. Let him meet the gods in death and see how wrong he was before he enters.